share with you my story. Would you share your valor with me?
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. It's 12:10. I'm John Williams. Pete Zimmerman is your producer, and here we go with an hour of news and information about the markets, the economy, and how it's affecting you.
Been a long old trouble.
Our first guest on Mondays is almost always Elise Glink, and today will be no exception. Elise from Think Glink Media. Visit thinkglink.com. Hi, Elise. How are you?
I'm fine, John. Happy Monday.
Thanks for saying that. I hope it's a happy Tuesday for people. What's the status of the stimulus talks?
Well, it's interesting. If you look at the stock market this morning, it was up 100 points on the hope that we were close to getting stimulus. And as the day has gone on, we're now down in the Dow about 100 points, and NASDAQ is down about 35 points, about a third of a percent. Not a lot, but I think people are starting to get nervous because Pelosi had given the White House 48 hours to reach a coronavirus stimulus deal, and the clock's ticking.
My understanding was that it was 48 hours to agree to a stimulus bill. They weren't going to dot the I's, but they were at least going to continue to negotiate on one or maybe have the terms set. Do I understand that correctly?
I think so. It's you got to agree in principle that, number one, you want to do something. And, you know, for Pelosi, who's already pushed through two different CARES Act, let's call it the second act of CARES Act, she pushed through one for about $3.3 trillion and one for about $2.2 trillion. And the president has offered $1.8 trillion, and Congress, on the other hand, the Republicans, the Senate, aren't sure they want to do anything. And so that, I think, is one of the big holdups here is what will Senate Republicans, some of whom are up in a couple of weeks for reelection, and, of course, they're all worried about the debt, what are they going to agree to?
You know, we were talking with some listeners about it earlier on the show today between 9 and noon. And I think we were equally critical of Republicans and Democrats. But a lot of my texters said that this would be going forward, but for Mitch McConnell and Senate Republicans. Is that your read?
I think that's right. I think he has walked this very interesting line all year between wanting to do things that will get, you know, everybody reelected and keep the president happy, and also the idea that, you know, these sort of the far-right Republicans who, you know, the people who are like Tea Party Republicans who said, you know, no more debt. We're already up $3.1 trillion in additional debt this year alone due to the pandemic, and we're just not going to stomach anymore. We can't get reelected with it. And so he has walked this line that I think is a very difficult line, and I think he, in a lot of ways, could push people into doing more, but maybe he can't. I don't know.
Can't politically. Can you talk to us about how effective the $600 stimulus checks were? Did that get into the economy? What did people do with them? How much did it help people? I mean, do we have any information on that?
We do, and it was wildly effective. So J.P. Morgan Chase did a new study where they looked at people in their checking accounts, actually the savings accounts at Chase, and you know Chase has millions and millions and millions of customers, and so this is data that I think is really interesting. And so what they did is they looked at the amount of spending that people were doing weekly in 2020, starting in January, employed versus unemployed people, and they looked at the amount of money that people had in their accounts, what they spent, and what happened after people started to get unemployed right at the end of March and into April, but then they received those unemployment benefits. And what they found is that the people who received the $600 weekly supplement actually spent far more per week than the people who were employed. They were actually out there spending that money. And while they were also building up their cash reserves, what we've seen now since is that the median checking account balance between employed and unemployed people has literally fallen off a cliff starting at the end of August when those extra $600 a week checks had expired,
right,
and then some of the other employment expired.
Well, you might expect that when the unemployment stimulus stopped, or not unemployment, but when the stimulus checks stopped, that people's checking accounts would go down. I'm going to pause here, but pick it up with the weekly spending. You just said that the people who were unemployed were spending more than the people who were employed. And what's the implication of that? Let's just talk a little bit about that in a minute. Elise Glink joins us. We're talking on the Wintrust Business Lunch about a proposed stimulus. And you were just talking about the history of the first round, Elise. And
yeah. So
before the stimulus and COVID hit, employed people were spending more than unemployed people, right?
Yeah, absolutely. They were spending on average, you know, somewhere between $600 to $700. And people who later became unemployed, right, they were supposedly employed, it tracks the spending but was just a little bit lower. And then when they were fired in March and April, and they started getting the extra $600 a week supplement, you see the line on the chart just go way above. It crosses, and suddenly they're spending more than people are employed. The lines are tracking similarly, but it's significantly higher now, with reaching a height of, I think in July, of about $700 a week of weekly spend. So they're spending their $600 weekly supplement and another $100 on top of it, and then you see the lines cross again at the end of August into the beginning of September, when those extra $600 stimulus weekly supplements expire. And you see it cross again, and then once again, people who are employed were spending more than people who are unemployed.
Because the stimulus by that time had been spent, probably.
It had been, yes, it had gone into the accounts, and then it wasn't in the accounts. And so what you were seeing was this dramatic pullback on spending. Just the way you saw, I mean, everybody pulled back on spending, John. I mean, I know I did. I'm sure you did in March and in April, because we were all so terrified at what was happening and we didn't go out. And so we're still not back. The spending still hasn't gone back for people who are employed to where it was prior to the whole pandemic starting. But it's interesting to see that now people who are unemployed are spending a whole lot less.
It's interesting because so everybody was spending around $600 or $650 a week, employed and unemployed. The unemployment, people obviously getting some sort of unemployment benefits. People that are earning money are obviously spending more. And that was kind of charting up in February up to March, then COVID hits, and then it, like you said, just goes to the bottom. Now instead of spending $600 or $700 a week, people are spending $300 or $400 a week, right? And then the stimulus hits, and then it starts to track back up because now people are either, I guess, more money's coming into the economy. People are spending more money, right? Am I reading this correctly?
Yeah, you are. That's exactly right. And we're seeing that people are trying really hard to get back to where they were, say, in January and February, which is actually a little bit down from the end of the year, right? Because what happens in January and February is people get their Christmas bills and the holiday expenses that come in for whatever trips you took and the holidays that you had and the gifts you bought. And so typically in January and February, we see, I mean, for decades this has been going on, a real focus on, hey, let's get your budget in order, let's get back to brass tacks, pay down that debt. And then by March, you start seeing an uptick in the spending again, and you would have seen that continue to
go up, yeah.
Go up, except we had a pandemic.
Okay.
Where we are now looks like it's starting to trend line back to where we were in January and February.
Which I guess isn't terrible. I mean, it's better than it was in March, April, May, June, July. But I want to make a point here. So maybe the second week in April, that's when unemployed people were actually spending more money than employed people. And by July, the gap was $7,500 a week difference. So I guess that's the value, but also the criticism of the stimulus check, or say the unemployment stimulus, Elise. I don't mean to make this sound as complicated as I now am. But the point is, unemployed people were spending more money than employed people in May, June, July, and some of August. And I guess that's because they needed the money and they got the money and they turned it back into the economy. That's good. But I think it's an argument for maybe some of the benefits were too generous, too, because working people were getting along with less than people who weren't working. You see what I'm saying?
Absolutely. And there were certainly, there are plenty of studies that show that the $600 really paid for people to stay home, which is what we wanted them to do, by the way, right? Stay home, stay safe, don't catch COVID. The problem now, John, is that all that extra money that people had banked, right? They didn't spend every dime they got, but they had really banked what they had. And they've used it up now since the end of July when the stimulus ended. That it, you know, the savings peaked in August, right? So July 31st was the last week of that. And then they went back to just getting the regular unemployment. And since then, their checking accounts have dropped through the floor. And what I think Jerome Powell, you know, at the Federal Reserve is saying is that these people are out of money. You know, you now have a significant number of Americans who have been unemployed for six months, and they're, you know, since July, we've had another, you know, August, September, October. These people are running out of money, and you're going to see a lot of people who literally can't afford their rent.
If you draw a straight line from the worst of it for employed people who were spending about $450 in late March when the crash hit, the markets were bad, and the and now we realize the full force of COVID, or at least we were beginning to. If you go from that low point to about, you know, the end of August, it's tracks steadily upward for employed people. They're spending. That's good. But now they are spending more than the unemployed because the unemployed just don't have any money left. The stimulus has run out and there are no supplements. So that takes us to today. Nancy Pelosi is supposed to be meeting with Steve Mnuchin today, as I understand it, to try and hammer out the deadline or the plan for the next round.
That's right. And one of the things that you're seeing come out of the Senate is a willingness to do a very pointed, small $500 billion piece. This is starting to be talked about as maybe, well, maybe we can just do this one thing. But there's also another thing that came out over the weekend, that 30% of small businesses will be entirely out of cash by the end of the year. So these were businesses that got the PPP loans that they were supposed to spend over 8 weeks. Many of them did. They've been scraping by ever since. But the word is now that an additional 30% of existing small businesses will be out of cash. And that would mean a whole lot of other people who will suddenly be unemployed who maybe have a job now.
Right.
And that's very, very worrisome.
And this is the conundrum for Congress then. You say, okay, well, then let's do that for sure. That's a good idea, too. And you know what? The airlines are not going to survive. We need them to survive, so we should have, and let's yet put some stimulus on there for the airlines. And you know, another good idea is the arts and entertainment business. As much as we are there to save restaurants and bars, the people that work at the theaters in town and the stages and the music industry and the artists, they got nothing. They are not included, so let's include them too. But now you've got a gigantic trillion-dollar bill. And some of the add-ons make less sense than I've just described. So while all of those little pieces seem like a good idea when you put them all in the same room, then you're starting to fight. If we just said $1,200 for these people, maybe they could agree on that at least. Maybe they could at least do that.
You know, this is why Nancy Pelosi got so mad at Wolf Blitzer the other day when she was on CNN, because her feeling is, you know, yes, you could say yes to the president and $1.8 billion, but it still would not include a bunch of the other, you know, audiences that you've just discussed, right? And you also don't know exactly what limitations Congress or the Senate would put on the ability to spend and get out there. And what about these small businesses? And really at the heart of it, I just have to point out that the heart of it is that we still have COVID with us. We don't have the solution yet. And all we're really trying to do, I think, is buy time to get to a place where all of us feel safe enough to take those vaccines that are coming out and feel like we're going to be able to get back into our lives. And so what we're trying to do in the big picture, in my mind, is buy everybody time to stay safe so we can get through it. And it's horrific that over 200,000 people have lost their lives just in this country.
You and I have to visit again. Maybe Pete could set this up later this week, and we'll play back that Wolf Blitzer, Nancy Pelosi conversation. I scored that as a win for him. I thought he exposed her political machinations, that it wasn't just about the economy and helping people, or that it's too unwieldy. I think it was clear that she had an agenda, and she was willing to use the politics to her advantage. I'm hearing you say something different, and I don't think any of us can answer with certainty what was going on in her mind in that conversation. But
well, I don't know that we're so. I don't know that we disagree quite as much as you think, but I'm game for another call about it.
Thanks for your time, Elise.
You bet, John.
Elise Glink, thinkglink.com. Continue on the Wintrust Business Lunch, produced by Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams. Jim Dahlke joins us on WGN Radio. Jim, I trust you're well.
I am, John. Thanks so much for having me. Great to be here.
Go to ChicagoInno.com to find out more reading and writing and reporting, the likes of which Jim does. He's a senior editor there. I want to talk about sports betting platforms in a minute, but before we do that, let's just start with ChowBus. We've talked to the people behind ChowBus here. We've talked to some of you about them, and they just keep getting bigger and better, don't they?
That's right. So ChowBus, a Chicago startup, they focus on food delivery, specifically on Asian cuisine, and just last week raised $30 million in new funding. That comes less than 3 months after they raised $33 million more dollars in a Series A funding round, so now have raised almost $70 million to date since they were founded in 2016. And, you know, the really interesting thing about ChowBus is that, you know, you don't think that there's much room in the food delivery space outside of the Grubhubs and the DoorDashes and the Uber Eats and even looking at Amazon and Instacart and all the ways you can get food delivered to your house. But here in Chicago, there's an under-the-radar startup in ChowBus that really is doing well. They have seen their growth just skyrocket during the coronavirus. Said earlier this summer that their revenue was up 700% year over year, now 300 employees, and really just kind of focusing on delivering this really authentic Asian cuisine to diners' doors, and just expanded to Australia this year too. So a lot of really, really fast growth for ChowBus.
$68 million to date. And is it that there's just some sort of cultural or language disconnect between that sector and the rest of the restaurant world?
Well, one thing that they've found is that they're able to provide this digital platform for restaurants that are really not available, you know, on the other third-party delivery apps. So they really specialize in connecting with kind of these mom-and-pop Asian restaurants that you're not going to find on DoorDash, you're not going to find on Grubhub, and really kind of providing a way for those restaurants to get additional revenue. And, you know, another thing that kind of differentiates ChowBus is they don't really focus on the restaurant necessarily. They focus on the dish. So
right.
If you really want orange chicken, if you really want, you know, a certain type of dish, you can find that on the platform, and then they will connect you with a great local restaurant.
And do they, I'm trying to remember now, when I make an order with ChowBus, do they just go to the one restaurant and pick up that item, or can I get items from multiple restaurants in one delivery?
That's right. You can get multiple restaurants. So it really kind of lets you make this sort of grab bag, you know, digital experience, right, where you're able to kind of go to multiple restaurants to get different items. So really that's kind of one of the ways ChowBus really kind of distinguishes itself from some of these other third-party delivery apps. And, you know, even they have plans. They announced this summer for a dine-in feature. So not just for delivery, but even when you go to visit a restaurant,
example,
you can order from your phone, pay from your phone, actually create kind of like a contactless dining experience.
So sports betting's quite the going concern in Illinois, isn't it?
Yeah, so sports betting is alive and well in Illinois. You know, Illinois was one of the more recent states to allow sports betting, and then this summer kind of opened up mobile registration. So sports betting has really started to take off here in Illinois, especially as the football season has gotten underway. And there's a startup in Chicago called BetSports that is kind of taking advantage of the growing popularity of sports betting and the legalization of it across the country. They don't, they're not a platform to place bets, but what they have created is a social media platform for sports bettors to enter and find gambling picks and kind of track different bettors and improve their betting along the way. So really interesting company, and BetSports just raised $1 million in funding earlier this year.
I presume that's an app, and is that live right now, or are they still developing that?
That app is live. So, yes, they are up and running right now. It's really a platform for you tracking your own bets and kind of finding other, you know, smart bettors along the way. And a new feature that they just launched this summer is a feature that allows you to sell your bets. So if you were a tipster, for example, you had some inside information, you can make a couple of bucks on your bets.
Well, what they should do is advertise on WGN Radio like the other 72 people in that space are, because it seems like I have no idea what the numbers are. But if you turn on radio or TV, any station in the city right now, the thank God for, in a down economy, a sector that has suddenly been blossoming, even though it's maybe not the most productive sector in the economy, but money's being spent. It's being churned through the market in the betting space.
Absolutely. All those companies, DraftKings, FanDuel, they are trying to gobble up as much market share as they possibly can because they know it's, you know, still early days, state by state. So it's been interesting to watch their rollout as sports betting gets legalized in city by city and state by state.
Would your guess be, Jim, that that's going to drop off after they've all sort of sorted out who's in first place, who's in second place? Or I wonder if they're going to be, you know, like car dealers. You're going to hear their commercials forever.
Yeah, and I mean, if you remember a few years ago when daily fantasy sports was really blowing up, you saw something sort of very similar. DraftKings and FanDuel on the daily fantasy side were advertising just about everywhere they possibly could, from TVs to bus stops to everywhere in between. And so I think that, these big, heavily financed companies are spending quite a bit of money to make sure that they can gobble up as much market share as fast as possible.
I hope they continue to. Okay, Jim Dahlke, Senior Editor, Chicago Inno. Visit ChicagoInno.com. We'll talk again later. Thanks, Jim.
Thanks, John.
It's 12:42 on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Steve Grzanich is looking at some other market news.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Mayor Lightfoot says all options are on the table in response to questions about a Tribune report that she's considering a $94 million property tax hike to help fill a giant budget hole. The report says it's one option, along with a gas tax hike, to cover a $1.2 billion budget shortfall in Chicago. The mayor is expected to outline her proposal on Wednesday. A task force will convene this month to determine whether to rename the University of Illinois at Chicago John Marshall Law School. The panel was created by the law school's dean back in August. The debate comes after new research determined that Marshall, an early Supreme Court justice, owned hundreds of slaves. The task force is expected to provide its findings and a recommendation by January 2021. For the sixth year in a row, Chicago is the rattiest city in America. Orkin Pest Control ranks every city based on the number of new rodent treatments. Cities usually trade spots on the top 50 list every year, but not Chicago. The city has remained at the top consistently. Orkin says the pandemic-related shutdowns have made things worse as rats search for new sources of food. Chicago's been trying to decrease the rat population for years, and a rat task force was launched back in 2016. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Someday there will be a vaccine. And Amy Guth joins us on the Wintrust Business Lunch to talk about, let's start with CVS. They're getting ready for it, huh, Amy?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So CVS has announced that they are hiring 15,000 workers, mostly pharmacy technicians, in advance of a COVID vaccine, whenever it shall arrive, as well as flu season. And so we've seen some FDA approval of allowing pharmacy techs and pharmacists to give COVID vaccines to people in retirement centers, workers there, once one is available. We've seen a couple of permissions like that roll out in anticipation of vaccines coming, hopefully sooner than later. But of those, that big number of 15,000 jobs, a couple hundred of them, about 250 or so, are expected to be here locally. Most of them will be based in Mount Prospect. CVS Health has a hub there. And so that's a few hundred jobs. Here's one area where we're seeing jobs go up, right? We don't report that often. We don't see that often.
Yeah.
We're usually seeing job decreases, but here is one spot where, they said we need to really kind of double down and staff up and get ready for all that's ahead, to get people vaccinated and to get through flu season in as quickly and efficiently as possible.
I don't know exactly what the training is or the skill set is for a pharmacy tech, but I suppose there are people out there in that world, and that's good news for them. I mean, it's also encouraging to note that even though we've had some setbacks on these various vaccines, that it is coming, right?
Yeah, and I think it's been really interesting to kind of look at the ancillary areas of business that are preparing for that. And, I thought it was very interesting
when people in the logistics industry, there's kind of an organization that if you are in the shipping and logistics world, there's this conference that you go to. And when they did their conference virtually this year, it was really focused on the logistics for what are we going to need to do to get billions of vials of vaccine around the world, and, yeah, and maybe frozen, maybe refrigerated. How do we do it quickly? How do we do it efficiently? How do we reach remote areas? How do we make it cost effective? I thought it was really, really fascinating, the kind of thought that's being put into what happens when it does arrive, because the vaccine could be invented, but we still got to get it to everybody. So I think a lot more to come on that once we get to that point of rolling it out and getting it to reach everybody, because it's only going to be effective if everybody has access to it.
It's earnings season. I'll talk to you about that in a moment, but you also follow the airline industry for us. What are you seeing today?
I do, and, you know, of course, you know, I follow Boeing very carefully and closely here in Chicago. So what they're doing right now is that they are exploring, they're doing like a systemic review of all of their real estate holdings, including the Chicago headquarters right there on the river. You know, I think we can all envision that building downtown. That doesn't mean they're necessarily going to change anything, but they're reviewing it all in a moment when, you know, Boeing was already really feeling the crunch of the grounded 737 Max aircraft after two fatal crashes, and then the pandemic hit. So they've really had a rough couple of years. And so they're looking at cost savings. Probably the first place most likely we're going to start seeing some consolidation is in Washington. They recently announced that 787 Dreamliner manufacturing was going to move to South Carolina. They already had a plant there. But rather than having two plants do the same thing, they're just going to consolidate that to South Carolina. And so they're looking at all these buildings and this campus space that they have in the Seattle area of what exactly that's going to be. So what seems likely, according to people that spoke to Bloomberg and a couple of other sources, were that likely they would start with downsizing that Seattle area, the headquarters of the commercial airplane division, and move some people there into another office building and just kind of shore up what they've got going there, really looking for some quick cost savings while they're riding out the pandemic at a time when, you know, air travel, as you and I have discussed, air travel has been impacted so very deeply.
So what happens to the Chicago site? Do you know the building here?
Well, unclear as of now, but I think a lot of people have that same question. The company's CFO said, you know, this is part of we're just doing our due diligence. We're looking to make responsible choices and make sure that we aren't, you know, losing money anywhere, that see if we could do this a better, smarter way. So unclear. I mean, it's such a major hub for them. It seems unlikely they would just jettison that building outright, but who knows? Maybe there'll be some subleases or something like that in there. Unclear, but something I'll be watching and we'll let you know what I find.
Are there any earnings reports that you're going to be following more closely than others?
Well, I am always fascinated by every time the quarterly earnings reports are out, because that really tells the story of business, and it's kind of laid bare at that point the reality of things. So I think the one that a lot of analysts are watching is a little bit later in the week. It's Wednesday. A lot of people are looking at Tesla. That's kind of, a lot of people have been looking at, that's going to be just kind of the, you know, the darling of the reports. We shall see what that looks like. But I'll also be really interested in, earlier today, IBM kind of talked about some spin-off plans for their infrastructure services so they can focus on cloud and things like that. They're going to announce theirs after the markets close today, so I'm very interested in that. Tomorrow we're going to hear about Netflix, which I will be very interested to see, because as you and I have talked about, a lot of our media consumption habits have changed pretty dramatically this year. So I imagine perhaps Netflix will have a lot of very good news. And then later in the week, we're going to also, you know, Thursday is kind of a big day. Probably about, I mean, several hundred are coming on Thursday. But Coca-Cola and AT&T, some of those really big names, you know, Coca-Cola had a rough couple of quarters because, as you and I have discussed, they really depended on things like sporting events and movie theaters for the bulk of their sales, not just one of us going to the store and getting a Coke out of the fridge or buying you know, things like that. So I think that's going to be really interesting to see what Coca-Cola does. Like, such a big giant of a brand here around the world, that will tell their story of what happened here for them in this quarter and around the world. So that will be things those are all things I'm going to be watching very closely.
Still to come. Okay, Amy, thanks for your time today.
Thanks so much, John.
Amy Gruth, this is the Wintrust Business Lunch.